side. He lifts the trunk, his skinny arms straining at the weight, and I wonder how long those little arms will last breaking stones. I point to the American storybook he's left. Don't forget this. He shifts the trunk to his other arm. You can have it, he says. Harish walks to the door, dragging the trunk. All the words he taught me, all the beautiful words, are useless now. Finally, I remember one that will answer the question he asked. How are you today, Lakshmi? As if today were just another day. Harish, I say. He just looks at me. Sorry, I say. I am sorry today. Then he is gone. Repetition. Lakshmi, I say to myself. My name is Lakshmi. Now that Harish is gone, no one says my name. So I say it to myself. My name is Lakshmi, I repeat. I am from Nepal. I am 13. I am not sure, but I think so much time has passed that I am 14. Like Anita. In the afternoons now, I watch TV with my head on Shahana's shoulder. But without Harish, I am like Anita. I cannot smile, even if there is a reason. Instead of Harish. Monica comes to my room today, her hands behind her back. Are the others all downstairs? She whispers. I nod. It is time for the bold and the beautiful. The others would all be laughing and cheering, while I lie upstairs in my bed, pretending that Harish will be home any minute to resume our lessons. Here, she says, take this. She thrusts a tattered grey thing in my direction. I examine it cautiously and see that it is an old rag doll, loved almost beyond recognition. Its button eyes are gone, its mouth a tiny red stitch, its dress thin and colourless. You can have her for a while, she says. You know, instead of Harish. She says this so quickly, her words barely register. I stand to thank her, but she is already gone. And I understand then, somehow, that Monica, the thirsty vine, Monica, the one with tricks to make the men pay extra, sleeps with this tattered rag doll. A strange customer. I have never seen such a queer-looking person. He has the pink skin of a pig. His hair is the color of straw. His eyes are ice blue, and he is wearing short pants that show his hairy monkey legs. But he looks like one of the people in Harish's storybook. He is too friendly, this pink American man. He grips my hand in greeting, a strange and uncouth gesture that makes me pull back in alarm. He says hello in my language. I say nothing in reply.
What is your name? He says.
His words are slow and clumsy, as if he has a mouthful of roti.
Your name, he says again, more slowly still. What is your name?
This pink man is the first man here to ask my name, but I don't give it to him.
How old are you?
I know what I am supposed to say, but something keeps me from lying to this pink stranger. I shrug. He is unmoved by my rudeness. Indeed, he smiles, his ice blue eyes oddly warm.
Are you being kept here against your will?
My will? This is something I lost long ago, I want to tell him. I want to pummel this pink-skinned man with my fists. I want to spit on this stranger with his eyes of cold pity, his idiot way of speaking my language, and his bad-mannered questions that make me look at the humiliation that is my life. I fold my arms across myself. He takes a little book from one of his pockets, consults its battered pages, then looks up at me. Slowly, with care, he asks me a question.
Do you want to leave here?
I know about these Americans. Anita has told me all about them. I will not be fooled into leaving here, only to be stripped naked and have people throw stones at me and call me a dirty woman. I shake my head, no.
You don't want to leave here?
I just stare at him.
I can take you to a place where you will get new clothes, he says, and good food, and you will not have to be with men.
I pretend I don't understand, because I don't. I don't understand how I will pay my debt to Mumtaz in this new place.
Do you want to go there?
I shake my head, no.
It is a clean place, he says.
I don't even blink. He takes his wallet from his jacket. I wait to catch a glimpse of his riches, but what he hands me is a small white card. It is full of American words I cannot read, and in the center is a drawing of a bird in flight. I put the card inside my waistcloth, and then he is gone. How odd he is, this man who pays for a girl and does nothing but talk. A small danger. I study the strange American card. It has words and numbers in tiny print. It is a small thing, flimsy and light, but I know it is enough to earn me a beating if Mumtaz or Shilpa sees it. If I put it in the trash in the kitchen, the others will see. If I throw it out the window, Mumtaz might see. And so I take this dangerous card and hide it under the mat on the floor. Until I can think of a better way to get rid of it. And then I head back downstairs and try to forget all about my strange visitor. A secret. There is a moment between the light and the dark when the smell of frying onions blows in through the windows. All over the city, the cooking hour has begun. This is the saddest smell in the world, because it means that here, at Mumtaz's house, the men will start to arrive. I am looking out the window, my whole being yearning toward that smell, when Shahana comes in. Shahana, I say, can you keep a secret? She looks around to make sure that we are alone, and nods. I had an American customer the other day, I say. He said he would take me away from here. Shahana moves a step closer to me, her dark eyes narrowed with suspicion. Did he say he would pay off your debt to Mumtaz? I shake my head. Then how would you get past her Gunta's? I don't know, I say. You know what Anita says, she whispers. She says the Americans will trick you and shame you and make you walk naked in public. I nod. I think about telling her what he said about the clean place, about the new clothes he promised. Perhaps, I say, Anita is wrong. Shahana looks out the window at the street below. But Anita's the only one of us who's been out there, she says. We are both quiet for a moment, watching the world outside go by underneath our window bars. Then Shahana grasps my hands in hers. If he comes back, will you go with him? She says. I don't know what to say. She squeezes my hands tightly, and her eyes burn with a fervor I have never seen before in my gentle friend. Will you take me with you? I step back. Shahana has been nothing but kind to me from the day I first arrived. She taught me everything I know to survive here. But she scares me now with this wild talk. I am afraid, afraid that Mumtaz will beat us senseless. And I am afraid that the Americans will shame us and abandon us in the streets. But most of all, I am afraid to imagine a life outside this place. Power outage. Now that the dry, hot months are here, there are nights when the entire city goes black. The electric lights go off, the music machine falls silent, the palm frond machine stops spinning and, for a moment, the whole city is still. It feels like the end of the world. If only it were. No remedy. I tuck Monica's little sock doll under my dress today and sneak down the hall to give it back to her. But as I round the corner, Shilpa catches me. Don't bother looking for your friend, she says. She is out on the street. Her words are thick and watery, the way they get when she has been drinking the liquor the street boy sells her. I wonder if I have misunderstood. I run to the window and look out on the street.
There is the usual assortment of vendors, schoolchildren kicking a ball, a policeman smoking a cigarette, but no Monica.
Where is she? I say.
Shilpa shrugs.
Mumtaz has no use for her anymore.
Why? I say. Monica was a good Anna.
Don't you know? She says. She has the virus.
In this city there are many diseases and many remedies. For the fever and chills disease there are white pills. For the coughing disease there is a special tea. For the itching and scratching disease there is a golden ointment. For the burning pain in the groin there is a shot from the dirty hands doctor. But for the virus there is no remedy. The street boy. I have been watching the street boy for some time now. I still do not buy his tea, but I no longer flee the room when he arrives. I know that he lets Anita have her tea, even if she doesn't have the money until the next day. I know that he puts extra sugar in the cook's tea in exchange for a stale heel of bread. And I know he sometimes cheats Mumtaz out of her change if she's not paying attention. Each day I hear him coming, the sound of his teacups clattering in his caddy as he arrives at the kitchen door. And each day when he comes to our room, I turn my back, so I will not be tempted to spend even a single rupee on a luxury I've learned to live without. Today, when he arrives, I am alone. He holds a cup of tea in my direction. The day is chilly, and his tea is warm and fragrant, but I pretend I do not notice. He lifts the cup to his lip and pretends to drink.
"Some tea for you today," he says.
His brown eyes are dark as Dali's. I shake my head, no. He lowers his head and scuffs one bare foot against the other. He seems about to say something more, but I turn my back, all the while thinking about his tea, about how good it would taste, how the cup would warm my hands, my throat, my whole being. And then he is gone, the cups on his caddy clinking and chattering as he retreats down the hall. Raid. What I remember is this. It was the middle of the afternoon. Shahana was upstairs painting her nails. Mumtaz was out getting herself fitted for a new sari, and Anita and I were in the TV room with the other girls when there was thunder at the front door. A man's voice shouted, "Open up!" The gunda at the front door, a skinny boy Mumtaz hired just a few days ago, leaped to his feet and ran for the back door. The girls jumped out of their seats and scattered like roaches. I couldn't move. Anita was running for the kitchen, but when she saw me, frozen in place, she came back, grabbed my wrist and pulled me along with her. The cook was waiting for us, holding open a panel beneath the sink. Anita crawled in fast, then pulled me in behind her. In the tiny, dark space, there was barely enough room for one person, let alone two, and so once the door was shut, we huddled there amid the pipes and rags and buckets, holding our breath. Soon we heard yelling. Men's voices came closer. Heavy footsteps coming toward us, down the hall, then into the kitchen. A man shouted at the cook. She cursed at him. Cupboard doors were flung open and slammed shut. There was a sound of rice spilling, a pan clattering to the floor, the cook shrieking and stomping her foot. The footsteps came close, then closer, and stopped. Anita's hand found mine, and we held on tight. Then angry voices came from upstairs. I could hear furniture being overturned, wood splintering, a man yelling, a woman crying. There was a stampede of footsteps, then running. And then the men were heading away from where we were hiding. Next came a heavy thud, a crash, then quiet. After that, all we could hear was muttering and the shuffling of feet. Eventually, the front door slammed shut. When it was finally still, the cook came and opened the cupboard. I climbed out, but Anita refused to budge. When finally she crawled out, I could see that Anita had wet herself. What I saw next was this. Rice and lentils, flour and spices, enough food for a week, strewn about the floor, a pair of rats nibbling on the spoils as the cook fought with them for what remained. In the next room, the TV was dashed to the floor, its magic window now 100 shards of glass. I ran upstairs, saw our room in chaos, our beds overturned, Anita's movie star posters ripped from the wall. The worst is what I did not see. Shahana. Aftermath. When all the other girls come out of their hiding places, and the ones who ran down the lane come back, we all huddle in the TV room. The cook runs off to the sari shop to find Mumtaz.
I bet it was the Americans, whispers Anita.
Shilpa spits. It was probably the police. Sometimes they take a girl when Mumtaz falls behind in her payment. I swallow and say nothing. Mumtaz storms into the TV room, her fat mango face slick with sweat.
Get to work, you lazy whores, she says.
When no one moves, she shoves Shilpa and she falls to the floor, nearly landing in a pile of broken glass.
Clean up this mess, Mumtaz cries, so we can be back in business tonight.
She doesn't say anything about Shahana. And when I dare to ask, the only answer comes from her leather strap. Gossip. The next day at the morning meal, Anita says it was the Americans who took Shahana away. The peanut vendor said he saw the whole thing. He told the cook, and she told Anita.
They probably stripped her naked and left her in the gutter, she says.
Shilpa says it was the police. A police officer, who is one of her regular customers, told her it was because Mumtaz didn't pay up this month.
They probably beat her and left her for dead, she said.
I cannot stand to hear them talk about my poor good friend, and so I rise and leave the table. The last thing I hear is one of them saying that we'll never know the truth. I go up to my room, lie on my bed, and pull the thin blanket over my head, because I know at least one truth. If these terrible things have happened to Shahana, it is all my fault. Immobile. Now that Shahana is gone, Mumtaz says we must service her customers as well as our own. I tell her I am ill, but the truth is that all I do is lie in bed and read Harish's beautiful American storybook over and over again. And so Mumtaz sends the men up to me. They come, a parade of them, and I simply lie here, unmoving. Today. As I lie in bed this afternoon, I see a rat crawl out of the privy hall. He claws his way up the bedsheet, then scrabbles toward the crust of bread Anita must have left on my pillow. We look each other in the eye for a moment. Then he runs away, my breakfast between his teeth. All I have left. Anita says Mumtaz is going to sell me to another brothel. Her crooked face is wet with tears. She says that if I don't get up and join the other girls, I will be gone by nightfall.
Please, she begs.
All I want to do is lie in my bed and repeat the beautiful American words from Harish's book, to say them over and over until one blends into the other, a chant that keeps all other thoughts away. I can feel Anita shaking my shoulders, and I can see her mouth moving in frantic pleas, but her voice is far away. All at once, there is a smack. I hear it more than I feel it. Then, vaguely, I am aware of a smarting sensation on my cheek, and I understand that Anita has hit me. I sit up, as if waking from a long sleep, and see this poor girl with a lopsided face. She is all I have left in the world. I rise, shaky, as Anita helps me to my feet. She puts her arm around my waist and guides me toward the mirror. Then she gets out her makeup brushes and lip colors and paints my face with such tenderness that I think my heart will break. A hiding place. The next day, as I'm walking down the hall, I hear a voice coming from the closet.
Psst, Lakshmi, says someone. In here.
I stop, open the door and see Anita inside the shallow cupboard, her body flattened against the wall.
"Next time there is a raid," she says, "I'm going to hide in here."
"But Anita," I say, "anyone can open this door."
She holds up a metal lock with numbers on its face.
"I stole it," she says, her crooked face half smiling. "From the grain bin."
I don't understand, until she points to a hasp on the inside of the door.
"We can lock ourselves in," she says. "Then no one will be able to open this door."
Another American. This one comes to the door looking somewhat lost. He is not as tall as the first one, and his eyes and hair are as dark as a normal man's, but my heart thuds when he points to me and he follows me up the steps. I wait for him to shake my hand, but he just looks around the room. I wait for him to ask if I want to go to the clean place, but he fumbles through his pants pockets and mutters something in a language I cannot understand. I know what to do. I lift the corner of the mat on the floor and feel around for the white card the other American gave me. I hold it out to him. He looks puzzled. He sits down on the bed. He seizes my braid and pulls me down on top of him as the white card flutters to the floor. It is then that I see the red veins in his eyes and smell the liquor on his breath. He is not a good American. He is just another drunk.
Calculations. It has been more than 2 weeks since Shahana left. A new girl is sleeping in her bed, but I take no notice of her. All I care about is my book of figures. I pore over the book that shows all my careful penciled entries, the money I've earned and the money I've paid Mumtaz for makeup, for nail paint, for the rotten rice that is my daily dinner, for my bed, for the visits from the dirty hands doctor. Today I will show her my calculations, the figures I've checked and rechecked and checked again, the numbers that say I will have paid down my debt by this time next year.
Just a cup of tea. The street boy is at my door again today. Again he holds out a cup of tea, and again I shake my head no. I go back to my book of figures and wait for him to leave. But he crosses the room, places the tea on the little table next to my bed, and, without saying a word, disappears. A recalculation. It is against the rules to speak to Mumtaz. It is Shilpa who does the talking for her. But I am standing outside the room where Mumtaz counts her money, waiting. I tap on her doorframe.
"Shilpa, you miserable girl, get in here," she says.
I push aside the curtain and enter her darkened room. She looks up, astonished. I say nothing. I simply hand her my ledger book. She studies it, glancing up at me, then down at my calculations.
"You are a clever girl," she says.
I bite my lip.
"But you are forgetting a few things."
She gets out her own ledger book, with entries more copious than mine.
"The medicine I gave you," she says, licking the tip of her pencil. "Your clothes, the shoes on your feet, the electricity bill."
She waves her hand toward the ceiling, where the fan chugs dully.
"Who do you think pays for the comforts I provide?" she says. "The fans, the music, the TV you girls love so much. Do you think all that is free?"
I bite the insides of my mouth.
"And then there's interest," she says. "You don't think I gave this money to your family for nothing in return, do you?"
I dig my nails into my palms.
"Of course not," she cries. "I charge half again as much for interest."
I blink back the tears welling in my eyes.
"You are a clever girl, but not so clever, are you?" she says.
I simply stare at her.
"Let me do the calculations for you," she says.
She pretends to be adding and subtracting.
"Yes," she says. "It's as I thought. You have at least 5 more years here with me."
Any man, every man. Here at Happiness House, there are dirty men,
Old men, rough men, fat men, drunken men, sick men. I will be with them all. Any man, every man. I will become Monica. I will do whatever it takes to get out of here. Whatever it takes. I have a regular customer now. He makes me do a nasty thing, but he gives me 10 rupees extra. I had a drunken customer yesterday. When he fell asleep afterward, I went through his wallet and helped myself to 20 rupees more. A deformed man came to the door yesterday. I told him I would be with him for 50 rupees extra. A warning. It is only mid-morning, well before the customers usually arrive, but a wealthy man with fine clothes and a shiny gold watch has come to the door. It is too early for others to be awake, so I go to him and ask if he would like to be with me. He looks me over. I tell him I will make him happy. He is considering this when Shilpa comes in and pushes me aside. Her eyes are wide and unblinking, the way they get when she has been drinking. She greets the man by name and wraps her arms around his thick waist. Then the two of them go to her room. Later, when they are finished, she comes to my room. Stay away from him, you understand? I understand that this wealthy man is one of her regulars, but I will not agree to what she asks. I will do what I have to do to get out of here. I shrug. Stay away from the ones that are mine, you hear me? She says. I used to fear Shilpa, but I look her in the eye. No, I say. Not if it means a few extra rupees toward what I owe Mumtaz. She spits. You stupid hill girl, she says. You actually believe what she's told you? I do. I have to believe. Monster. A new girl arrived today. I know because I heard her sobs through the door of the locked-in room as I passed by on my way to the kitchen. Mumtaz is a monster, I tell myself. Only a monster could do what she does to innocent girls. But I wonder, if the crying of a young girl is the same to me as the bleating of the horns in the street below, what have I become? Passing the time. Some days the time between when I awake and the time when the customers arrive is so long and dull and tedious that I can only lie in bed and watch the spinning of the palm frond machine. These are the days when I understand Shilpa and the way she loves her liquor. And so when the street boy comes today, I do not pretend I cannot see him. I look at his caddy and point to the bottle he has brought for Shilpa. He shakes his head. This is bad stuff, he says in my language. Once you start it, you cannot stop. What do you care? I say. He looks down, fiddles with his wire caddy for a bit, then looks back at me, his dark brown eyes as wide and unblinking as Tali's. Then he takes a cup of tea from the caddy and holds it out to me. Take this instead, he says. I shake my head. He turns to go, then stops. I can bring you other things, he says. I can bring you sweet cakes. I sigh and try to remember the time when a sweet cake was enough to make me happy. I turn my face to the wall. He leaves without making a sound, but I can tell from the aroma that fills the room that once again he has left me a cup of tea. Suspicion. Shilpa passes by my room with her gold watch customer. And I try to remember what it was she said the other day when she warned me to stay away from him. When I told her I would do whatever I could to pay my debt to Mumtaz, she said that I was stupid. Her words come back to me. You actually believe what she tells you? I wonder, what can she mean? Shilpa is Mumtaz's spy. She is the one who guards the door to her counting room. She is the one who seems to know Mumtaz's secrets. I have seen Mumtaz's record book. I know how she cheated me. But I wonder, does Shilpa know something I don't? A Coca-Cola. The street boy is at my door again today. He is holding a bottle of Coca-Cola.
For you, he says.
I am curious about this drink. The people who drink it on TV are happy when its tiny fireworks go off in their mouths. I have no money, I say to him.
It's okay, he says.
I regard him with some suspicion.
Why are you giving this to me?
He shrugs.
And why do you give me tea without asking for anything in return?
He kicks one bare foot against the other.
We are both alone in this city, he says. Isn't that reason enough?
He doesn't wait for my answer. He removes the cap, and the bottle hisses at us like an angry snake. I shy away from it until it has finished its hissing. Then I take the bottle from him and bring it to my mouth. Little bubbles, so tiny they cannot be seen, sneak out from the bottle and tickle my nose. I think I will sneeze, but nothing happens. I take a sip. It is true. A dozen tiny fireworks go off on my tongue. I cannot help but smile. The street boy is smiling too. Then Shilpa calls out to him from down the hall.
Get in here, you lazy boy, she cries.
He turns to go.
I can bring you other things, you know, whatever you like, he says. I know everyone in this town.
I have no need for other things, I want to tell him. This small gift is more than enough. Paying a debt. Today, the street boy shows up late. He scurries past my door, his eyes downcast. I call out to him, and he peeks around the doorframe. His brow is cut, his cheek swollen with a big purple bruise.
What happened? I say.
The boss, he says, touching his face gingerly.
I ask him why his boss would do such a thing.
If I don't collect for all the drinks, he says, sometimes he takes it out on me.
We are both quiet for a moment. I open my mouth to tell him I am sorry. At the same time, he opens his to say, it's okay, and then we are quiet again. He turns to leave, and I see that his clothes are worn thin, that they are nothing but rags.
Come back tomorrow, I say.
He looks puzzled. But I do not tell him that I've decided to borrow from Mumtaz, just this once, so that tomorrow he doesn't have to face his boss empty-handed. Revelation. Shilpa is alone in the counting room when I get there. I tell her I want to borrow 40 rupees. She spits.
You are even stupider than I thought.
I do not care what this drunken woman thinks of me. I just want enough to pay the street boy what I owe.
What do you care? I say. It is my money. My family won't miss a few rupees.
She laughs.
You think the money goes home to your family? She says.
I tell myself she is talking nonsense, the nonsense that comes when she is drunk.
Bimla may have given your family a little sum when you left home, she says. But the rest, the money from the customers, goes to Mumtaz. Your family will never see one rupee more.
I put my hands to my ears, but still I can hear what she is saying.
You will never pay off what you owe, she says. Mumtaz will work you until you are too sick to make money for her, and then she will throw you out on the street.
I shut my eyes and shake my head from side to side. She is wrong, because if she is right, everything I've done here, everything that's been done to me, was for nothing. A kind of sickness. It has been 3 days since I learned the truth from Shilpa. I ran from her, straight to my room, where I was sick to my stomach all day and night. For 2 days more I lay in bed, too wretched to move. But last night I rose from my bed, put on my makeup, and went back to work. And today, when the street boy comes, I will be ready. Today I will ask him if it is really true that he knows everyone in this town. And today I will show him the small white American card with a flying bird on it. Stupidity. The street boy is standing in the kitchen, and all the girls are gathered around him. He says today is his last day.
The boss is giving my route to a new boy, he says with a shrug.
The other girls tickle and kiss him and tell him they will miss him. The cook ruffles his hair with her hand, then slips him a piece of fresh bread. Anita takes a rupee note from her waistcloth, presses it into his palm and says goodbye. Shilpa asks if the new boy will bring her what she needs. I look at him with frantic eyes. He says not to worry, it is not my fault. He steps toward the kitchen door. My heart is pounding so hard I think it will burst from my chest. I do not think. I run to him and throw my arms around him. The others cackle and bray. Stupid girl, Shilpa says. She must be in love with him. I do not care if she thinks I'm in love with him. I don't care if she thinks I'm a fool, because I didn't just hug him. I whispered in his ear and slipped him the flying board card. Waiting. More than a week has passed since I gave the street boy the flying board card. Each day the new boy comes in his place. The new boy is slow and surly. He does not joke with anyone, and he refuses to give out so much as a single teacup without getting his money first. I ask if he ever sees the boy who used to bring us our tea. Who? He says. I realize then that I do not even know his name. Not a new girl anymore. I look around the table at mealtime. There is a pair of new girls. One is sniffling over her rice and dal. The other is 2 days to eat. A third girl, one who has been here a while, is wiping her plate with her bread. The first one is sitting in Monica's old seat, the second in Shahana's. The third is sitting where Pushpa used to sit. It occurs to me that, except for Anita, I have been here the longest. Coughing. I awake in the middle of the night to a familiar sound. It is the hacking of someone with a coughing disease. It took me a moment to realize, though, that Pushpa has long been gone, and a moment more to realize that this time it is Anita. Digital magic. It is only afternoon, but already a customer is at the door. I see at once that he is an American. It is not the same one who gave me the flying board card. This one is taller, and he is wearing a vest of many pockets. I shrink behind the doorframe. Every day I have prayed for an American to come. Now that one is here, I don't know what to do. I hear a noise from the counting room and see that Shilpa is watching. So I go to the man like a thirsty vine. I tell him I will make him happy. I tell him I know some good tricks. Shilpa goes back to her movie star magazine, and the man follows me up the steps. When we get to my room, he grips my hand in greeting, the same uncouth way the first American did. I pull away. He says hello in my language. I say nothing in reply.
What is your name? He says.
His words are hurried, and he looks nervously over his shoulder.
Your name? He says again. What is your name?
I cannot open my mouth.
How old are you?
I don't reply. He sighs.
May I take your picture? He says.
He takes a small silver box from one of his pockets. He touches a button, and its eye blinks open with a whir. I do not like this seeing box, but I do not object.
I will not tell the fat woman, he says. You have my promise.
A tiny lightning jumps out of the box. The eye blinks shut. And for a moment I see doubles and triples of the man, framed in a red glow. He is smiling, looking at the back of his little lightning box.
Come see your picture, he says.
I take just one step toward him and wait. He holds the silver box toward me, and I can see a tiny version of myself, smaller than the people on TV, in a tiny TV in the back of the silver box.
Digital, he says.
I don't know this word, but it must be the name of the strange American magic he has that allows him to put me in his silver box.
Do you want to leave here? He says.
I cannot answer. How do I know if he is a good man? What if he is like the drunken American? What if he is like the ones Anita talks about, the ones who make young girls walk naked in the street?
I can take you to a clean place, he says. Look, he says. pictures of the shelter, other girls.
He holds out the silver box so I can see the tiny TV in the back. He pushes a button. There is a tiny image of a Nepali girl smiling back at me. He pushes the button again. There are girls in school uniforms sitting at a desk. Girls fetching water at a spring. The man turns off his digital magic machine. I am afraid all of a sudden that he is leaving. I wish there was a way to say something, to keep this American here a little longer. I reach under my bed and pull out the American storybook, the one Harish gave me. I hold it out toward the American. He cocks his head to one side, puzzled. I point to a picture. Elmo, I say. He nods slowly. Ice cream, I say.
Yes, he says. Very good.
America, the man smiles. I do not mean to, but I am smiling at this queer-looking man, smiling and trembling at the magic, not of his digital image-taking box, but at the magic of a handful of nonsense words to keep him here a little longer. Believing. The American man whispers. His way of speaking my language is hurried now, as he reads from a battered Nepali word book. I see that it has the image of the flying bird on its cover, and I say a silent prayer of thanks to the street boy whose name I will never know.
What the fat woman does here to you is bad, he says. Very bad.
I nod.
She cannot force you to do these things, he says.
This American is not so magical after all, I decide. He doesn't know about Mumtaz's leather strap and the gundas and the chain on the door.
I will come back for you, he says. I will come back with other men, good men, from this country, fathers and uncles who want to help, policemen who are not friends of Mumtaz. We will take you away from here.
This is too good to believe.
You must believe me, he says.
I shut my eyes tight. I don't know what to believe. I believed that the stranger in the yellow cloud dress was taking me to the city to work as a maid. I believed that Uncle Husband would protect me from the bad city people. I believed that if I worked hard enough here at Happiness House, I could pay down my debt. And I believed it was all worth it for the sake of my family. I am too afraid to believe him. And so I am going to believe that this strange pink man is a dream, a cruel trick of the mind. I am going to believe that when I open my eyes, he will be gone. I count to 100. Count to 100 again and open my eyes. He is still there, gripping his battered Nepali word book. The clean place, I say. I want to go there. Namaste. The American man says he will come back. He will return, he says, as soon as he can, with the other men and the good police officers who will force Mumtaz to let me go. When he returns, I must go with him quickly, before the gundas can try to stop us. He bows and says, Namaste, the word in my language that means hello and goodbye. And then he is gone, leaving me to wonder if he was really here at all. Ready. When no one is looking, I pack my bundle for my journey to the clean place and hide it under my bed. What I am taking... My American storybook, a hair ribbon Shahana left behind, my notebook, my old homespun skirt, Monica's rag doll. What I am leaving behind, the makeup and nail paint Mumtaz made me buy, the condoms under my mattress, everything that happened here. Two kinds of stupidity. It has been 3 days, and still the pink-skinned man hasn't returned with a good policeman. How stupid I was to believe in him and his digital magic. How stupid I am to keep believing. Forgetting how to forget. I learned ways to be with men. I learned how to forget what was happening to me, even as it was happening. But ever since the pink-skinned man came here, with his pictures of the clean place, I cannot remember those ways. Now, while I wait for the American to return and the men come to my bed, I clench the sheets in my hands for fear that I will pound them to death with my fists. I grit my teeth for fear that I will bite through their skin to their very bones. I squeeze my eyes closed tight for fear that I will see what has actually happened to me. Playing the fool. 5 days have passed, and still there is no sign of the American. Only a fool would keep waiting after 5 days. A kind of illness. This ache in my chest is a relentless thing, worse than any fever. A fever is gone with a few of Mumtaz's white pills, but this illness has had me in its grip for a week now. This affliction, hope, is so cruel and stubborn, I believe it will kill me. Punishment. It is a simple kitchen sound, the grinding of spices with a wooden pestle. Sometimes it means nothing more than spicy stew for supper. But sometimes it means that the cook is readying the hot chili punishment for one of us. And then it is a sound that turns even the hardest woman here into a whimpering child. Because it means that someone has crossed Mumtaz, that Mumtaz will smear chilies on a stick and put it inside the girl, and that all of us will be awake through the night listening to the girl moan. Anita inches up next to the cook, but doesn't dare to ask. Mumtaz is furious, the cook says. One of the girls has betrayed her. My legs give way beneath me as the tender place inside me imagines the burn of the hot chili stick. And then I am sweating and piecing and quaking and trying to figure out how Mumtaz learned about the American. I am shivering and shaking and forming the words I will use to beg for mercy. My stomach is heaving with fear as I hear the heavy thud of footsteps in the hall. But when Mumtaz enters the room, I show her the face of a docile Nepali girl, a girl who will put up no fight. She storms past me, and I flinch as the hem of her sleeve brushes my arm. She pushes the cook aside, takes her stick, rolls it in the chili powder, and wheels around to face me. I fall to the floor, kissing her feet and weeping. She gives me a kick in the ribs, and all the air flies out of me in a whoosh. Then she is gone. Soon I hear a piteous wailing coming from the next room. Anita bends over me. "It is Kumari, the new girl," she says, stroking my hair. She accepted a bangle bracelet from a customer. My shameful heart rejoices that it is Kumari, not me, who is crying. But I wonder, if this is what Mumtaz did over a bangle, what would she do if she knew about my American? I press my cheek to the coolness of the floor and close my eyes. When I open them, I see Mumtaz's painted toes inches from my face. Anita's feet scurry away. "You certainly act the part of the guilty one," Mumtaz says from above me. What I feel next is the gritty sole of her shoe on the side of my head, gently at first, then with steady, gathering force, relentless, building pressure, until her full weight is on me. She grinds her foot, and the metal edge of my earring bites into the flesh of my ear. But I do not cry out. The seconds tick by. Then somehow I am outside myself, marveling at this pain, a thing so formidable it has color and shape. Fantastic red, then yellow, starbursts of agony explode in my head. Then there is a blinding whiteness, and then blackness. Somehow, without warning, the pain is gone. A new pain takes its place as Mumtaz yanks on my braid and drags me to my feet. We are eye to eye. I can smell the sour tang of her sweat. "Have you done something for which you should be punished?" she says. I don't answer. She yanks on my braid. My scalp yelps with pain, but I don't say a word. "Have you done something wrong?" she says, spit gathering in the corners of her mouth. "Tell me, you stupid little hill girl." Mumtaz has called me a little hill girl.
which is still what I am.
I meet her gaze.
No, Mumtaz, I say. I haven't.
She lets go of my hair, and it takes all my strength to keep my knees from giving way.
Then put on your makeup, she says, and get back to work.
I stay upright until she is gone. Only then do I slump to the floor and touch the side of my head. My earring comes off in my hand, bloodied but intact, and I know then that my earlobe has been torn clear through. I know something else as well. I know that I would endure 100 punishments to be free of this place. The words Harish taught me. It is so late at night, it is almost morning, and I am awake, ready to begin another day of waiting for the American. There is a banging on the door, and a voice shouts, "Police!" Anita bolts out of bed.
"Hurry," she says, grabbing my hand. I am right behind her, sneaking down the hall toward her hiding place in the closet. We can hear voices coming from downstairs as we tiptoe down the hall.
"I'm here for a young girl," says a man.
"What kind of place do you think this is?" says Mumtaz. "There are no young girls here."
I know this voice. It is my American. I squeeze Anita's hand.
"It is an American," I whisper. Her eyes go wide. "He is a good man," I say. "He will take us to a clean place."
"It's a trick," she says, inching toward the closet.
"No," I say. "I've seen pictures. The girls there are safe."
She shakes her head.
"They are liars," she says. "I beg you, don't go."
The American is shouting something. I don't understand what he is saying, but I know, somehow, that he is calling out to me.
"Please," I beg her, "come with me. If you stay here, you will die."
Anita is clutching my arm.
"Don't go," she cries.
I cannot move. I cannot go to my American. And I cannot walk away from my crooked-faced friend.
"The new TV is coming any day now," she says. "Mumtaz promised."
She grips my arm and tries to pull me into the closet with her. I shake my head. Then, slowly, she lets go of my arm, closes the door between us, and I hear a sad and final sound, the lock sliding into place. I am alone in the hallway. Mumtaz is coursing downstairs, but I can still hear the American. I inch toward the steps, but I am too afraid to go down. The American calls out. I try to answer, but nothing comes out of my mouth. I hear more cursing and the scuffle of feet. He is leaving. My American is leaving. Something inside me breaks open, and I run down the steps. I see Mumtaz, her fat mango face purple with rage, her arms pinned behind her back by two policemen. She lunges in my direction and spits, but the policemen hold her back. I see my American. There are other men with him, Indian men, and the American lady from the picture. "My name is Lakshmi," I say. "I am from Nepal. I am 14 years old."
Author's note. Each year, nearly 12,000 Nepali girls are sold by their families, intentionally or unwittingly, into a life of sexual slavery in the brothels of India. Worldwide, the U.S. State Department estimates that nearly 500,000 children are trafficked into the sex trade annually. As part of my research for Sold, I traced the path that many Nepalese girls have taken, from remote villages to the red-light districts of Calcutta. I also interviewed aid workers who rescue girls from brothels, provide them with medical care and job training, and who work to reintegrate them into society. But most touching and inspiring was interviewing survivors themselves. These young women have experienced what many people would describe as unspeakable horrors, but they are speaking out with great dignity. Some go door to door in the country's most isolated villages to explain what really happens to girls who leave home with strangers promising good jobs. Some of them, even women who are ill with HIV,
patrol the border between Nepal and India, on the lookout for young girls traveling without their parents. And some are facing their traffickers in court, where it is often their word against the fathers and brothers, husbands and uncles, who sold them for as little as $300. It is in their honor that this book was written. This concludes Sold. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers. Or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalog.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.